Time for Lunch is a new podcast from HRN for curious young eaters, where we focus on the serious questions.
Aren't chickens tiny dinosaurs?
We get to know our favorite foods in unexpected ways.
We just like cheered like you would cheer for your classmate when they're rounding second base in softball. And we just like, peach, 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 peach. Yay, thank you, peaches.
Learn some new recipes and jokes.
What does a boxer's mom put in his lunch? A knuckle sandwich.
And load up on fun facts.
Experts estimate that there are between 1 and 2,000 types of insects eaten around the world.
So roll up your sleeves and dig in. Subscribe to Time for Lunch on your favorite podcast app so that you and your favorite young eater can catch up on the whole first season. New episodes of season 2 out each week.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Learn more at brooklynballfactory.com.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We normally broadcast live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, but our studio is currently closed due to the outbreak of coronavirus, as everywhere else in the world. So we are recording this episode remotely from my apartment in Brooklyn. So this show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Maribeth Boiler, who is a chef with impressive experiences. She worked under some of the greatest chefs in the world, like Michel Roux in London, Jean-Joel van Gelichten in New York, and she served as a private chef for the U.S. Ambassador Caroline Kennedy from 2013 to 2017 in Tokyo. And she continues to cook in Japan since then. So today we'll discuss challenges Maribeth came across while she was working as a chef for the American Ambassador to Japan, why she decided to stay in Japan, and when the job was completed, and what's special about Japanese culture for her, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write to a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any comments or requests for show topics or guests, please let us know. You can email us at japaneats@theheritageradionetwork.org or akikokatema.com. Now let's start a conversation with Maribeth Boiler. Hello, Maribeth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you?
Very good. And so sorry that we have to ask you to stay up late because you're calling in from Japan. So
that's okay. I'm usually up this late. I'm just not usually having an interview this late. That's the only difference. I wouldn't be asleep. I just wouldn't be talking to somebody in New York.
Right. So I have many questions for you. So first of all, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
I'm born and raised in New York. Born on 12th Street between 5th and 6th. My dad was actually a doctor at St. Vincent's Hospital in the West Village. So born and raised in New York, I kind of always gravitate. I would leave and then come back to New York. I went to college in Rhode Island. I worked in London and a couple of locations in France and New Mexico, but I would always come back to New York. So New York is my home, although Tokyo is my home. I'm definitely a New Yorker in heart. And I ate very, very well. I'm the youngest of seven, a really great family. I'm super close. We ate pretty basic. I mean, it was a big, big family. There was 9 of us. So it was not always the most adventurous, but very kind of basic. The protein, the starch, the veg. And by the time I rolled into high school, my siblings, because like I said, I'm the youngest, everybody started leaving, going to college and then not returning, or some would return and go to law school, or, you know, staying in the house. But by the time I hit high school, there was more freedom to go out to, we ate out quite a bit, actually. So I was really fortunate.
Wow. So it sounds like you had a basic balanced home cooking, and also you discovered all those New York City dining scenes. So sounds perfect.
Perfect. I don't know. I mean, it wasn't always the healthiest, in the 70s, 80s. But I certainly can't complain. We were well fed, and I was very fortunate to have been exposed at an early age to some pretty great restaurants, either through my parents or through aunts who would take me to, you know, Four Seasons and the Sherry Netherland, like really cool kind of places. So it was kind of fun as a little girl. Mm. I was obsessed with Julia Child and asked for a waffle iron from Santa. So I was kind of a freak. I mean, I was really into food.
Right. But why exactly, you know, you decided going to pursue a culinary career?
I just always really gravitated towards cooking. I mean, I started making cookies when I was little and kind of morphed into helping my mom and then helping my aunts cook. And like I said, I was really into Julia Child, and my parents used to buy me her cookbooks, and I used to watch it on TV, her show. And I knew that I wanted to do that, but I wasn't 100% sure when I was in high school. And I was 16 when I went to college. It's pretty young. So I went to, I have my degree in business. I went to Providence College and I studied, a business management degree, because I wasn't 100% sure about the culinary field. And I felt like, well, it's a good idea to go get college under my belt. And then when I get out, if I'm serious, I'll pursue it, which is exactly what I did. So when I got out of school, that's when I met Jean-Georges Van Gerichten and started working with, he hired me. I had no restaurant experience at all, but he hired me and I started working with him.
Wow. So you had some personal connection with Jean-Georges, or?
Through a man named Marc Sarrazin, who was a really amazing guy who owned he owned a Bag and Spittler, which was a meat vendor, and he was kind of like the chef broker in a way. And late 80s, 90s. So he, just through like a indirect friend, that kind of a thing, of my father's physician who also worked with my father.
Wow. So it's like
friend of a friend, right, kind of a thing. So it felt like another French guy who knew Jean-Georges. Jean-Georges had just opened up Lafayette, or was just at the Drake Hotel. And so he connected me to him and he hired me right away.
Well, it sounds like it's not just, you know, you had a good connection, but it's hard to prove that you're so good. You know, it's Jean-Georges anyway. So it's very impressive. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I wasn't so good. I was just very eager to learn, and I think really enthusiastic. And I think that's why he hired me. And then, you know, I mean, doors open sometimes easily, but they shut even easier. So yeah, I mean, if you connections are great, but they only go so far.
Right.
if you don't put the actions behind right. it.
And you worked also at, you know, the John George, who's a French chef, and the Michel Roux in London. And and I heard also you worked at the Le Gavroche in London, and I think really the top restaurants. So what did you learn from those experiences?
I feel like you could learn something everywhere if your eyes are open and if you're open to that. The Jean George, he was my first chef. He was an amazing guy and he was an amazing mentor. Worked with wonderful people on the line. I mean, I was a kid, and the people that were on the line were really tremendous. And I had the advantage of I went to night school three nights a week, and then I would come in, worked full time for him, and ask a million questions and tell them what I learned. And then they would tell me, oh no, that's really stupid. Don't do it this way. It this way, you know? So it was kind of like, so I don't know, between the two, it seems like something, I learned something.
Right. And also your night school was at the International Culinary Center in Soho, right?
Yeah. Well, it was the French Culinary Institute. Now it's the ICE or the culinary.
Yeah.
It's changed names. So it was a good school. And this way I was able to work full time with him. So he kind of convinced me to change my original plan was to go to the Culinary Institute of America, and he convinced me not to do that so I could stay with him. So that was a great experience. And then because I was working on the line with these really awesome older guys, I knew I wasn't going to ever run the station, so to speak. So I told him I was bored. I can't go anywhere with this. So he sent me to France to where he had done his apprenticeship at the Auberge de Lille, which is 3-star Michelin. And I worked there, and I lived with his family on weekends. And then I worked at the Hotel Martinez in Cannes. He was awesome. So he helped facilitate those positions, and he was really supportive in me learning from other people too, not just kind of holding me near and dear to him, so to speak, you know, because I think that's a huge thing. I mean, I feel like you can learn from anybody, and it was really important to train with a few people,
right?
Because you learn, even if you learn that you don't want to do it one way or the other, right. You know. So, and the Roux brothers were the Michel Roux was Albert was the father, and Michel was the son, and this is Le Gavroche, and it was intense. It was brutal. We worked 85 hours a week in 5 days.
Wow.
Yeah, but it was awesome. I mean, it was amazing work, incredible pressure, but beautiful, beautiful restaurant, beautiful food, perfectly cooked. You really learned a lot, and you learned a lot about yourself and your strengths, weaknesses, and you'd even learned how you wanted to treat people or how you didn't want to treat people.
That's huge.
You know, it was tough.
Right.
Yeah. It was tough.
Right. Really tough. At this point,
okay. Thanks.
So maybe you can just repeat the important thing you said about learning from other people. Like, no.
I just said that I have found, and particularly if you talk about Le Gavroche, that you learn about yourself, you learn about your strengths, you learn about your cooking abilities, but you're also, that kind of place was a sink or literally like sink or swim or survival of the fittest. It was a very strange place, but a great place. And you learned more than cooking, a lot about yourself and your strengths, weaknesses, and your ability to deal with your coworkers and help and support, and also to how to treat people, whether you agree with the way the kitchen was run or the treatment or not. You know, it's kind of your, I think I got a lot out of that. And I'm lifelong friends that were on the line were pretty amazing.
Wow. So it's almost like in the military or something, like you really work.
Oh, it was totally, yeah, it really was kind of crazy. I mean, I could write a book just about
maybe
that.
Maybe you should. But then you worked as the executive chef at the legendary dining destination, BG at the Bergdorf Goodman in New York, which is an upscale, highly sophisticated department store. So what kind of, I mean, you now, you moved on. How did it happen? Also, what kind of menu did you offer in what kind of style of cooking?
At Bergdorf, I went there after I had done catering. I was the executive chef at Great Performances, which is a huge catering company in New York. And then I also had my own catering company. And they had, I was approached by a friend who knew that they were looking for somebody at Bergdorf. And I figured that would be an interesting change. So I started with them, and it was really fun. I had never done that kind of I'd never worked in that type of restaurant. I mean, they have, I ran their three restaurants, and it's really, it was a gorgeous restaurant. And they're very concerned about health, you know, health conscious, a lot of late meals. We had to do a number of them that were 500 calories and below. It wasn't so very different from what I previously had cooked or my style. It was kind of, I was fortunate enough to be able to cook my style of food, which was very seasonal and locally sourced.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, okay. So just because we have a lot more questions, I just wanted to make sure that, so you, after you left Jean George, and then studied in France, and then eventually you studied your catering business, and then you are invited to become the chef. And it's it's interesting that now you're the executive chef and managing three restaurants. So based on what you learned, you're now the team leader. And it sounds like you've been building your career, even at the point, very solidly and surely. And then you got... In 2014, you left New York to accept offer to serve as executive chef and events planner of the U.S. Embassy residence in Japan under Ambassador Caroline Kennedy. So how did it happen?
She had been my client for, at that point, about 15 years.
Wow.
I had spent every summer in Martha's Vineyard cooking for Ambassador Kennedy and her Ed and her family. I can't remember when it started, but it was at that point. Right now, it's about 20 years. So it's we met each other. I was hired as their private chef for one summer, and we really hit it off, and it kind of morphed into a great long-term relationship where I then in my spare time would cook dinners for them, and then their private events, and then their corporate events. It just kind of morphed into a great, very close relationship. And when she had accepted her position in Tokyo, we talked about me maybe going over, and it was decided that she would go over and see what the position was like. You know, I said that I was very interested in moving over, but it would have to be, you know, the right circumstance. If it was good for me, if it was good for Ambassador Kennedy, if it was good for the embassy, then we should have a further dialogue. So she went off and moved to Tokyo, and it took about 3 months, and then she called me and asked me if I would move.
Wow. That's exciting.
Yeah. Like, what? Yeah. She's like, please move over here. Yeah. So I did. And it took a while. So that was, I don't know, that was probably the winter of 2014. And it's not, you can't just up and move. There's a process. So there was a lot of things that you have to do through the embassy and check, you know, security checks and so forth. But I ended up moving the October 2014, and I was super excited. I mean, I was happy in New York, but I felt, number one, I love her dearly. And I knew that she would not be kind of throwing me under the bus, like that it had to be a great place. And she was so excited for me to join her here, that it was just all good. And I also felt that there was a time limit. So I knew that she would only be here for 2 years or so max. So it didn't seem like a difficult decision. Mm-hmm. And then it really wasn't until I didn't expect to be here as long as I have been, really.
Right. So, did you have any culture shock or language barrier at the beginning?
I don't think culture shock. I mean, I like to travel, and I think that it was, I'm not intimidated. I don't get intimidated by, you know, I never thought, oh, this is big and scary. You know, I mean, I'm from New York, so it's not, I always think it's very similar to New York, except that you can't read anything here or understand anything. But so I kind of thought of it as fun, interesting adventure. And particularly because I was so close to her, that I'm very, very confident that it was nothing intimidating, all good, really all good. I think that obviously there's a different culture, and I think that there were adjustments for sure. I mean, I feel like there is, the pace is much slower, the pace of business is much slower, or movement in general, took a little while to get used to. I don't even know if I'm still used. I'm still really not used to it, to be honest with you. Who am I kidding? It drives me crazy. The language, of course, it's really hard. I'll have to take lessons for the rest of my life. I still take them. I have a lesson on Thursday. But I didn't. I think that if you let that be a huge bummer or scary, then it will be. If you just decide, okay, this is going to be a challenge, but I can deal with it, and I'm not going to let it stop me from anything, then it's okay. You figure out ways to navigate it. I did a lot of traveling by myself, and I would just bring, you know, be prepared, know what you're doing, or have a plan, have a little cheat sheet of, you know, certain things that you may need to be able to, you know, have to ask, or things written in Japanese that you might want to pull out of your pocket and ask, you know, if you didn't feel confident enough to say it. So I never really had a problem. Mm,
yeah, I think that's the
yeah, way. I mean, the heart.
If you see it as a kind of challenge that you can grow out of, then there's nothing so hard in a way. I think it seems like you're enjoying those challenges.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the obvious challenges are in cooking, with sauces and things of that nature. Like, it's not, I'm not intimidated to go to markets and things like, of course, I mean, I know what a good fish looks like. I know vegetable, you know, that kind of a thing. I think the layer of difficulty in food would really be more going to grocery stores and looking at, you know, 20 bottles of brown sauce. That how the hell do you figure out what that is? And honestly, I was so lucky because I was working for this amazing woman who said, okay, well, buy a bunch of them and just figure it out, you know, and literally. So that's what I would do. It's not like I didn't go in and buy 100 bottles of different soy sauces and things, but I would just experiment, and then you figure out what you like and what works. And I think that's kind of steered the way I cook now, because nobody told me how to cook with any of this stuff.
Right.
I never really took, I mean, I took a couple of little Japanese lessons, but I kind of found some of them really boring because they were very basic. But if nobody's ever told you what certain things are for, and you've just opened up the bottle and you've tasted them, then you'll put those things with things that you think they work with, not with what the rules are telling you.
Right. And then all those, you know, challenges you were facing, and at the embassy in Tokyo, so you were in charge of planning and designing both large events and intimate gatherings, and that reflected the multifaceted relationship between the United States and Japan. And that sounds very kind of almost overwhelming. So what is the most difficult part of the job, and how did you manage that?
It does sound overwhelming, and it wasn't. I mean, I thought it was, I came from very big experience. See, that's what I think. I think that, you know, I was the executive chef at Great Performances. We could do 20 parties a day, and one of them could have been the opening for the, you know, Philharmonic and the Met and this and that. You know, it's like, so thousands. I'm used to cooking for thousands. So it was more, I think the challenge was much more, it's not that it was an easy job, but I think the biggest challenge or hurdles were getting locals to accept change.
Right.
I think sometimes that's, new things are seen as intimidating, so not so eager sometimes. But that's a little bit of a generalization. But there was definitely some people that were very stuck in their ways and not really interested in seeing some new and different. But
are you talking about your co-chef, like team members?
No, I think just in general, like the style of, say, the style of events, or they were kind of old fashioned to me, and certainly to, you know, Ambassador Kennedy brought me over because she wanted to have things that were her style and something that was fresh and new and exciting and cool, and that wasn't really happening there. So it was, that's the biggest challenge, was to introduce people to things that they weren't necessarily familiar with. And yes, I'm talking about the people that I worked with there, the locals.
Right.
Obviously the audience, the people that were the guests, they were psyched. Right. You know? But so it was just, and it wasn't like it was some crazy large challenge. I think once people realized that change is good,
right,
then slowly they would.
Yeah, I think in Japanese mindset, it's hard to change something because,
yeah,
as you said, things move slowly because everybody agrees on something. So if you want to change everything, everyone has to, it's like a chain reaction. It sounds like probably the reason that, you know, the old ambassadors bring their own private chefs is to educate the cultural style mindset through food as well. So I think you did a very meaningful job over there.
And I actually was I was the first one that has ever been brought over.
Wow. Wow. Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I don't know whether that's good or bad.
But, it is great. So what was, maybe you can give us an example of most memorable event that you worked on for the
community? There were a lot of great ones. There was a one for 500 or 600 for the JFK symposium and Bill Clinton spoke and he attended. So that was kind of a big deal. That was also a fell on St. Patrick's Day, which Ambassador Kennedy, it's a big day for Carolina.
Right.
So everything had to be green. It was like, it was pretty funny. But that was kind of a neat one. And then another one that was really fun was for the governor of Kentucky. Ambassador Kennedy had the idea to surprise him by bringing in miniature ponies. She had met when she was in D.C. for a conference. She met a Japanese woman who owned two miniature ponies that lived in an apartment in Tokyo, only in Tokyo, right? I'm not serious. I am totally serious. They lived in an apartment in Tokyo. So I met them. I met the ponies, went to their apartment, and had little coats of roses created with a local florist so that it mimicked the Kentucky Derby.
Oh.
I'll send you these pictures. It's really hard to explain, right. But it was hilarious. And people people were so shocked. And Ambassador Kennedy brought them into the building and it was just really funny. Yeah, it was fun. I'll send you the pictures because they really were.
Okay.
It was fun.
I look forward to it.
Yeah.
And then I heard that you fostered what you call food diplomacy through relationships with local vendors and food sources and your contacts with U.S. affiliated restaurants and vendors. So could you elaborate on it?
Sure. Again, this was something that I don't know how strong that was pushed with previous ambassadors, but it was really important for Ambassador Kennedy and for me, and particularly for, there's one event a year, it's the 4th of July event, so it's usually for about 1,600 people. And previously, it would just be all about American products. So it would be, you know, McDonald's or Kentucky Fried Chicken. I felt, we both felt like, is that really what we want to do here? And it wasn't what I wanted. Well, I'll answer that. No, it wasn't what I wanted to do. So we switched it up. So the focus was American products, U.S. products with local vendors. In other words, a local taco guy, we supplied him. We asked him if he wanted to participate. And so he produced his burritos in the same way that he would normally do it. But we provided U.S. pork, U.S. cheese, U.S. sour cream. So it was a partnership type thing. Local soba producers, we provided buckwheat from North Dakota so that they could create their same traditional method. So it's not like we were saying, here, use this crummy product, really good product that they were able to showcase their wonderful food products, but using an American ingredients. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. So it's almost like for good food to be deepened and expanded for its opportunities rather than just nationalize where it should be from.
Yeah. Well, I think that it was, I mean, for that, for this yearly event, it works really well. I mean, it's all about, you know, independence and, or, you know, the 4th of July, you're working, you're we're here in Tokyo. We love our Japanese neighbors. What better way than to take American products, which because it's the U.S. Embassy, you're supposed to be showcasing, but not just throwing American products in everybody's face, but taking those products and working with local small Japanese producers who it's almost like good PR,
yeah.
You know? So these people were able to show their products to an audience of 1,600 people who otherwise would not have seen them.
Right. Yeah, I think it's real cultural exchange. And I see, for example, there are sake producers in the States using American-born native Kalos rice. which is really tasty. So yeah, that kind of thing is really meaningful. And yeah, that sounds wonderful. So to you, well, you mentioned a couple things about Japanese systems. And so what's so unique about Japanese food system?
I mean, Japanese food is just great. I think that it's, for me, there's so many things to learn. You know, I feel like it's just never ending, the amount of things that I can learn here. But I think, and I think that there's such a deep respect for food. I feel like no other country, people just love their food. Like people, it's almost like an extension of their family. It's kind of, it's a little borderline bizarre, but you know, like the way somebody might speak about their mekan or their oranges if they're from Kyushu, or you know, you really think that they're talking about their uncle, but it's an orange. You know, it's, there's this bond. I've never really experienced anything like that, and I've lived in very food centered countries, but yeah, I mean, there's just, I think it's just the a deeper respect for food. Food is everything here.
Right. Yeah, and I think the mindset of from farm to table or sea to table has been always there in Japan. So yeah, it's kind of like vertical. The distribution system is really not commercial, but it's more spiritually connected, like you described.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, and so you have very rich global culinary experiences, like you said. And so France and UK and New York, and of course in Japan. So how do you call your style of cooking at this point of your life? And what is your culinary philosophy?
My style is, I don't think it hasn't really changed. It's very, you know, I cook locally sourced food. I cook seasonal. I think it's simple, though when I say it's simple, a lot of people think I'm crazy. Maybe it's not so simple, but I think it's relatively simple. Not a lot of manipulating or playing with food. I think that it's kind of more, it's morphed a bit here in a way, because I do use a lot of different Japanese products in a Western way. I don't really, I think the, what I have found here, what I've learned here is that Japanese cooking, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, many people just follow traditional rules about sauces or mix, don't mix this, or this is what you're supposed to do with this sauce or that sauce or whatever. Like I said, I don't really do that. I mix more flavors than I think most. So a little, maybe you would think a little bit out of the box. But I think it's fun. I don't think that there, I would prefer not to categorize, you know, a region, or, you know, I don't cook Italian, I don't cook Japanese, I don't cook New York. I just cook what's in front of me and what's season's best, and hopefully it tastes good.
Right. Well, that's how the food culture in any place has been developing, and it will continue to develop. So, yeah, that's amazing. And do you have any signature dish to represent your?
I don't know about signature dish, but there are some things that I tend to use often. Like I'd make a dashi broth, but then I add Parmesan rinds to cook for hours.
Wow. Yeah.
It's pretty, yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty yummy, pretty tasty.
That makes sense, right? Because umami, all different kinds of amino acids, they multiply by merging together. So.
Right.
I have to try it.
Exactly.
I'll try it.
You should try it. And then you should try the other, the combination of... if you like do a frico, like a Parmesan, but then I put a little bit of, I put katsubushi and I put nori, shredded nori, and bake it.
Whoa. Yeah, it's a hands down. It should work. But the same idea, right?
No, it does taste really good. But that's not something, you know, I remember doing cooking for my friends and they were just, you know, they couldn't believe it tastes, they said it tastes very delicious. But it was also as if I had just, you know, created the light bulb. Like it's not that, it's just, I think it just tastes good and right. That's why I do it. It's not really not to be pushing anybody's envelope. Right. It's just kind of, it's almost comforting.
Well, it makes sense, right? It's scientifically too. So listeners, it's dashi and parmesan rinds. And also the other one is bacon and nori and bonito flakes to make some yeah. stocks. Okay. All right, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss why Mary Beth decided to stay in Japan and what is special about Japanese food culture for her. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Brooklyn Ball Factory uses the best ingredients to make Japanese comfort food, like their bento boxes featuring meatballs, grilled veggies, Japanese fried chicken, or pork shabu shabu. Plus, visit Brooklyn Ball Factory's sister restaurants, Momo Sushi Shack, Samurai Papa, Samurai Mama, Bozu, and Kitade Shokudo. Learn more at brooklynballfactory.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats Podcast and live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn, my apartment in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema. My guest today is Mary Beth Boyer, who is a former private chef for the U.S. Ambassador Caroline Kennedy from 2014 to 2017 in Tokyo. So Ambassador Kennedy completed her mission in January 2017, but you decided to stay in Japan. So why is that?
I had decided probably maybe 6 or 7 months prior to that. And I had originally I thought that I would stay at the embassy on a part-time basis. I think we both expected Hillary Clinton to win, which was unfortunate the way things went down, I think, for everybody in the world. But when I did leave the embassy, we both left January 17th, the day Donald Trump started. And I thought, I'm not quite done with Japan. I felt that there was a lot more that I could learn and see and do. So I just looked at my options. I had no job. I had no visa. I had, you know, and tried to figure it out. I started taking more Japanese lessons. I reached out to some people and eventually figured it out and started doing a variety of different things. So I'm really happy that I stayed. I felt like if I didn't, it would have been much easier for me to pack up and leave, go back to New York. I mean, much more, would have been easier and definitely a solid situation, but I didn't want to do it. And I'm really happy that I did it.
Okay. So what are your activities in Japan right now?
Right now, I am doing a number of different things. I'm still doing consulting. I've been consulting for ANA Airlines for a few years. I've done consulting for Mitsui Fudosan. I did that about 2 years ago for a really interesting project. I lived on Awaji Island, worked with an agricultural group for 6 months, the farm group. That was really ridiculously amazing.
I've never been to Awaji Island, but sounds like it's very kind of special, like naturally.
It's beautiful. I lived in the middle of a sweet potato farm. And it was so bizarre, actually. but really beautiful. I mean, I just kept it. There were moments where I, moments of near madness, you know, really, truly. Wow. But then I thought, well, I'm never going to do this again. I this is so far from New York. And so just enjoy it. And I did, actually. It was pretty great. What else? So currently, I'm still doing the A&A consulting for them, which is really neat. I just launched a meal delivery service called Noka Soul. Our plans are also to open up a fast casual farm to bento concept restaurant in the fall. So that's pretty exciting. And then what else? I've been doing some consulting for Jetro. And actually, just before this horrible coronavirus, I had a group from Neiman Marcus come over and visit Japan. We focused in Saga. I was hired by Jetro and Saga.
Right, so Jetro, this is most familiar with it. It's a Japanese government organization who promotes exports, imports, and businesses between Japan and other countries. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, they had hired me to, they basically asked me if I would help them come up with some ideas to generate more distribution of artisanal products. Mm. So I thought about it. I went to Saga. I explored a bunch of different places, selected some places that I thought were really amazing to kind of focus on. And anyway, long story short, Neiman Marcus, the head buyer for Epicure and the head of all the restaurants, the VP of restaurants, came over to visit and they loved it. So they loved Japan, and hopefully there's going to be a Japan fair in 43 of their stores.
Wow, that sounds amazing. Wow.
So that's going to be really fun. Yeah, I hope, hopefully. I mean, you know, the world is so crazy right now.
But, well, Japan is really in control in terms of the coronavirus. So
yeah. I know, but it's not, yeah, I know. We'll have to see. Yeah. I mean, it's great over here, but it's not happening, you know. Right. There's a lot that needs to happen in the U.S., as you know.
Yeah. So, well, sounds like a lot going on. And it's you know, what's happening in Japan in terms of the food world too. So I'm curious, based on your experiences, what is the food trend among Japanese people right now? And I, for example, I heard that plant-based diet is not as popular as in the US, probably because they already have a lot of vegetables in their own food and on a daily basis. So yeah, what's the trend?
I see more trends. I mean, there's definitely a little buzz about, there is a buzz about vegan, you know, but I don't think it's big, like, it's not like the States, but I do, like, I have a friend who just wrote a book, and there's a little buzz about it. I think more, I could certainly speak about trends like food halls, you know, that's definitely, there's two that just open up. There's one that's opening up in 2 weeks, a tiny one. I don't know how, I mean, it's a tiny space. That's going to be tough. But that seems to be, in the past several years, they have really grabbed onto that.
Because food halls that concept have been very popular in the States, like, you know, the gourmet food halls, like in New York City. Is that kind of thing? Like, really?
Yeah, no, I'm thinking, yeah, like Time Out Cafe in Dumbo, for instance. I mean, I can tell you the places in New York, and then I can tell you the places that are here that are kind of like, I can tell they've seen the places in New York, and then they try to do it here. Right. So I feel like that's the kind of trending. I think that there's always a spotlight on what's happening in New York, or what's you know, what they think, what seems to be kind of cool in New York or in the US, and then there may be something that attempts or tries to mimic it here. And sometimes it's successful and sometimes it's not authentic at all.
Right.
But interesting.
Mm, okay. So, yeah, I'm just very curious. That it sounds like a very Western idea to have hulhuls, but is this the more communal idea? It's almost like market concept in fancier buildings, so that makes sense.
Yeah, but when I say food hall, I mean, you know, so it's a number of different restaurants, almost like a little, not kiosk, more than a kiosk, but a step above a kiosk. So it's like Chelsea Market, you know, think about Chelsea Market, but on a smaller scale.
Right.
That kind of thing.
Right.
Or, yeah, yeah.
Mm. Okay. And so you are one of the precious culinary professionals who have highly global perspective about food at this point. So what do you think we should learn from the Japanese food culture and what Japanese should learn from other food cultures?
I think there's so much to learn from Japanese food. I think that it's a real shame that people don't know more about Japanese food or Japanese products. I think it's a real shame that the products aren't easily accessible in cities like New York. I think, and I know that there are Japanese stores and you can get some stuff, but a lot of the stuff is mass produced. And I'd love to see a larger variety of the small artisanal products make their way
right
into the hands of people. And I think that there needs to be kind of teaching and explaining what things are. And again, I think that they could do exceptionally well, Japanese products, even kind of maybe some funky artisanal products, if they are brought to the consumer in a really, in a way that educates people about the product and in a way that eliminates the intimidation factor of how to use and what the products are, because then people will be much more apt to give it a try and embrace them. And it's the same can be said for, say, U.S. products here. I worked for the California Olive Oil Council for a while, and the idea was to try to introduce small batch olive oils to consumers here. And people didn't know what to do with it. You know, if you don't really know that certain olive oils are not for sautéing, they're just for finishing or things like that. Like, you have to kind of explain that certain things can, you know, you just have to teach people that how to use things and how not to be keeping things in the, again, I think it's more about thinking out of the box and making things, adapting things and different products into your comfort zone.
Right. Well, I think now the information is available over the internet, but I know that like small Japanese artisanal small producers, say go to, you know, the fancy food show in New York or those very limited outlet they can introduce their products to the world. That's really frustrating. And I'm
very frustrating, which is why I'm so excited about the whole Neiman Marcus opportunity. If that really does, you know, I do hope that works out, because that in and of itself will be able to bring over some really fantastic products and put it on a platform that wouldn't normally be there.
Right.
You know, for those kind of consumers that will be okay with trying something a little new and different.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that's a pretty, I really am very excited about that.
Oh, please do keep me posted. I'm very interested in that.
I will.
Right. So what are your plans?
My plans are to keep on keeping on. You know? It's sort of like I can't come back. I can't go back there. I would love to go. Generally, I go back to the States. I've been lucky enough to go back every summer. This is going to be the first summer that I'm here for the duration. So I'm busy working on my new projects. It's busy. I'm busy, but I'm missing my family. Yeah. That's the bottom line.
Originally, we were supposed to record this episode in the studio, so nothing didn't happen.
Exactly. Well, that wedding was canceled, obviously, but I keep thinking, oh, well, I'll be able to go in August, and then it's like, oh, well, then I'll be able to go in October. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, it's depressing. So that's for now. I'm here. Hopefully everybody stays healthy and this thing gets under control and then we can travel with a little more freedom. I mean, my plan is to stay in Tokyo, even pre-corona, the plan is to stay in Tokyo, stay in Japan, but working on these certain business opportunities that will allow me to spend more time in the States because I really do need to go back there more often.
Right. Well, sounds like you're really becoming an ambassador by yourself. So congratulations.
I don't know about that.
I see it. So. Yeah. So where can we find your updates online?
My website, which is marybethbowler.com, MarybethBowler. .com and the company that we just started, myself and my partner, who's a Korean woman who owns 5 F&B establishments in Seoul. Our business is called Noka Soul, NokaSoul.com.
Okay, great. All right, so. Yeah. Good luck with everything, and hopefully eventually we'll see you in person at the studio again.
I hope so. Yeah. Right. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today, Marybeth. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japannews@heritageradionetwork.org or kikokatema.com. Japan Needs is always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Engineer today is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.